Three messages before we get started. If you're a tech entrepreneur, don't you have unique legal needs that the average lawyer can't help you with? That's why you need Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. If you read his articles on VentureBeat, you know that he can help you with issues like raising money or issuing stock options or even deciding whether to form a corporation. Scott Edward Walker is the entrepreneur's lawyer. See him at walkercorporatelaw.com. And do you remember when I interviewed Sarah Sutton Fell about how thousands of people pay for her job site? Look at the biggest point that she made. She said that she has a phone number on every page of her site because, and here's a stat, 95% of the people who call end up buying. Most people, though, don't call her, but seeing a real number increases their confidence in her and they buy. So try this. Go to grasshopper.com and get a phone number that will make your company sound professional. Add it to your site and see what happens. Grasshopper.com. And remember Patrick Buckley, who I interviewed? He came up with an idea for an iPad case. He built a store to sell it, and in a few months, he generated about $1 million in sales. Well, the platform he used is Shopify. If you have an idea to sell anything, set up your store on Shopify.com because Shopify stores are designed to increase sales. Plus, Shopify makes it easy to set up a beautiful store and manage it. Shopify.com. Here's the program. Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. How do you build a community that people are willing to get on a plane and fly out to be a part of? Every March, over 14,000 smartphone-carrying, website-building hipsters, like me, flood Austin, Texas for South by Southwest Interactive. They come to talk business, to hear about the future of tech from people who help shape it, and to drink. I like that part a lot. Hugh Forrest is the event director for South by Southwest Interactive. I invited him here to find out how the event got to be so big and so important. Hugh, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Hugh, who are some of the speakers who've spoken at South by Southwest Interactive? Give me some of the big names. Impress my audience.
People who've spoken over the last 5 years range from someone like Malcolm Gladwell to Jane McGonigal to a Will Wright. Bruce Sterling has spoken many times and is scheduled to speak again in 2011. We've had Mark Zuckerberg. So hopefully a lot of the thought leaders and creativity leaders in the, quote, interactive space.
All right, now I've seen people who thought they were important in blogging and magazine writers who thought that they were important try to get a guy like Mark Zuckerberg to talk and discover that he's just not that accessible. I'm going to want to find out how that happened, how you got these guys to speak. Let me toss in another name, someone who I love watching at South by Southwest, Gary Vaynerchuk. Man, that guy will pump you up more than Tony Robbins, more than any musician. He's good. But you were with South by Southwest before the interactive part. I think you joined, was it 89? What was going on back in 89 when you joined?
Well, in 1989, it was a music-only event. My story is that I had a computer and they didn't. So that was my ticket into the organization. In 1994, South by Southwest added what was a combined film and multimedia event, and then in 1995, we split those off into two separate events. So the interactive event has been around, named somewhat differently, but since 1994. I think that we, you know, really found our voice over the last 4 or 5 years, meaning we had a very, very long incubation period and certainly probably would not have survived had we not been supported by Southwest Music, which has, you know, was attracting lots and lots of people and able to support this smaller event that didn't really know what it was doing yet. And hopefully we have begun to figure out what we're doing now.
I can't wait to dig into what happened during that slow period and why you guys kept it going and why it started to move up about 4 or 5 years ago, as you said. But before then, at the very beginning, why did there need to be a music festival in Austin, Texas?
Well, there had the people who organized South by Southwest, my boss, had been going to an event in New York for many years called the New Music Seminar. And in fact, at one point, they had had significant discussions with the people who were organizing the New Music Seminar about coming to Austin doing an offshoot event. And then finally they decided, well, we could probably do this ourselves. Austin, you know, has traditionally been a very, very strong music community, so it made sense to do it here. One of the other, you know, interesting stories about when it started, when South by Southwest started way back when, and this was actually 1987, because there were 2 years before I joined, is that, you know, no one, when they were starting this concept, starting this idea, no one really knew what to think of it, and the ticket or entree into a lot of these clubs was spring break week, which, you know, Austin is a college town, and you have 40,000 college kids leaving town during spring break, so it's traditionally the worst week of the year for these bars. And the entree into these clubs was, we'll do it spring break week, look, it can't be any worse than your bar totals are now. And that allowed them to get in a lot of clubs who might not have taken a chance in this thing. Now, flash forward 20 or 25 years later, or even 15 years later, and that spring break week has become the most lucrative week for most of the bars and restaurants in Austin, meaning they do, you know, as much, anywhere from, 30% to 50% of their business for the year during that week, just because so many people have come to town. So my point is, I think that's a lesson for all of us as entrepreneurs, is that find something that's a perceived weakness and make it a strength.
So I understand that there's some people who would otherwise go off somewhere else for spring break and are looking for something to do, or would be open to going to a bar or club to listen to music in Austin, but that doesn't seem like it's enough to get a big festival off the ground. What else did you do to bring more people in?
Well, the event was, the founders were very involved with the Austin Chronicle, which is the weekly paper here in Austin. Mm-hmm. So they had connections with other weekly papers throughout the U.S. and leveraged those connections to get ads in these papers, to bring the editor or music writer to town. So that helped create a degree of buzz back in the day when we all used to read newspapers, right?
Yeah.
As well, it was, it was pitched and envisioned and as a conference for music industry people. And at that point, there were not that many of those type of conferences available. So, taking a traditional conference structure and taking it to an industry that didn't typically have that kind of event. And certainly Austin itself is no small player in this scenario. People like coming to Austin. People particularly like coming to Austin in March. It's the weather is generally warm in the day, can get cool at night, but spring has arrived here where it may not have arrived elsewhere. So the city is very much a part of that and helped attract a lot of people. And so that provided a good basis for what we started here.
What was the conference, or what was the event at first? It was local bars and clubs where musicians would play. Was there anything else?
Well, from the start, on the music end, it was panels during the day, with the idea that it was music industry people talking to musicians during the day. And then at night it was showcases. So the idea is that musicians were then playing to those music industry people at night. And the music industry was a lot different 25 years ago. And the idea at that point was, the goal was to get signed, quote unquote. I don't think we, I'm not sure that there were ever that many successes of bands getting actually signed in Austin as a result of South by Southwest, but as the band stuff is very similar to what happens with the New Media Interactive stuff now. Even if you don't get signed, it's about making connections, learning things, being creative, things that can take your career to the next level. And the people who are able to successfully do that, whether it be music or film or interactive, can get a whole lot out of the event.
Okay. All right, and so in 1994, as you say, you guys created South by Southwest Film and South by Southwest Interactive. Why Interactive? Why take this big, cool people festival where they're all listening to music that's cutting edge that the rest of us still hadn't heard of and say, you know what we need to add on to this? Guys who want to just look down at their iPhones or look at down at their Trios with whatever phone was around back then.
Pre-Trio at that point. Well, that's a great question. I mean, I was, you know, I was working on what was then multimedia back then, and you know, I was still very confused as to what this brave new world was and how that, you know, and I think in those days there was a significantly different or greater division between the people who were attending Interactive or multimedia and the people who were attending music. So I think from the perspective of my boss, it was very forward thinking to have this technology event. Again, it took a long, long incubation period for it to really reach a point where it took off.
Why was it? Because there was going to be more money in it? Was it because, hey, you know what, we have the infrastructure in place, we have people here to help organize it, what else, who else has some money that we could bring in and sell sponsorships to and then grow out? Or was it because Interactive back then, multimedia was considered a new art the way that movies were, and the plan was to tap into this new art form before it got too big? What was the vision like? How did it fit in?
I think the vision is more of the latter. I mean, the film side is very clear on why they did that, and that two of the founders of the company were very involved in the film scene around the University of Texas, so they always wanted to do a film festival. The idea of including multimedia in this, which at that point were, you know, CD-ROMs and as you said, Trios, was visionary in the sense that we could see that there was maybe something somewhere down the line, but not yet. I think also what you mentioned about having the structure in place, that was part of the idea there, that you had the structure in place of how to run a conference or how to theoretically run a conference, and why not maximize that by putting in another event, which then again split into two events.
Why did you guys decide to add more to the current location, the current event, instead of taking your event on the road and maybe having the North by Northeast or any of the other conferences that others have created?
Well, actually, we have tried that. It didn't work.
Oh, you did?
We were involved with an event in St. Louis for a while called the Mississippi River Music Festival. Mm-hmm. We were involved with an event in Portland, Oregon called the North by Northwest Music Conference and Festival.
Look at how I nailed the name.
There you go.
I didn't nail the research, apparently, but I nailed the name. Why didn't those work?
You know, I think that our big lesson from that is that we didn't have the skill or the organization to franchise this thing. The of these other events that we've done, North by Northwest had a lot of moments, but it never kind of hit a tipping point similar to South by Southwest. Now, there is still a North by Northeast in Toronto, which is licenses the name from South by Southwest, but essentially is independently managed. And that's, you know, that's had a lot of staying power, so that's still going pretty strong. But again, I mean, we realized trying to do these events in other cities that we just did not have the manpower or the skill to pull this thing off, and we ought to concentrate more on our strength, which was Austin. That said, you know, the event in Portland allowed us to explore a lot of things that we later brought into Austin, so it was kind of a good place to explore new ideas and incubate those ideas and then bring them back to Austin for South by Southwest.
I'd like to spend a little more time on this, if you don't mind. I love studying the setbacks because I think there's a lot more to learn from the setbacks than there is from success. Success, often we overlook all the mistakes that we've made or don't notice what works because we're just on a high. In setbacks, we have some time to evaluate. So do you have an example of something that didn't go right with one of the other offshoot conferences, that maybe an incident that captures what was wrong with the, or what didn't work out?
Well, one of the biggest challenges of doing the event in Portland, and I was very involved with that, I would spend half the year in Austin and half the year in Portland, was that we were perceived by the Portland Music Committee as people from Austin, Texas, coming to Portland to run a music festival. And, you know, what do you guys know about the Portland music scene? And I think we did a lot to try to integrate ourselves with that scene and tried to reach out, but ultimately we're not that successful in those efforts. What I've learned from that, or what I hopefully learned from that, is just how important community is, whether it's real or virtual. And I think, you know, ultimately that's one of the biggest secrets to success for what Interactive has managed to achieve in the last few years, is being able to tap into this very, very creative interactive community, and carefully grooming that community and carefully refining our role in that community and knowing when to push a little and to pull back a little. But again, that's always what I say is the biggest strength of the event. It's less the intelligence of the organizer and more the collective intelligence of all the people who are coming to Austin.
Let me address something for people who are watching the video and not just listening to the MP3, which I know most people do. There are a couple of things you guys are seeing. First of all, this big device right here in front of me, it's the mic. I've been getting a lot of noise from my computers going into the mic, so I'm trying a new placement. It looks a little ridiculous here. The second thing is, I noticed that you keep leaning forward to adjust your computer. You're on a Mac, right? On a Mac, the screen dims every couple of minutes, and you have to move your mouse to keep it from dimming.
That's me.
I am always curious about this stuff. Like, if I watch Leo Laporte, I won't pay attention to what he's saying sometimes. I'll watch what's going on behind him. What's that doll that he's got behind him? So I figured I'll explain to my audience what the doll is in front of Andrew. It's a crazy old mic. Portland, how did you seem that you were out of the community? Can you give me an example? I want to understand how people could even feel that South by Southwest isn't authentically Portland.
Is inauthentically Portland or authentically Portland?
Is not. I had a double negative. How did they feel that it was not authentically Portland? How did it feel like a foreign community or foreign music being brought into the Portland community?
Well, again, most of the organization work was being done from Austin. And
but how does that impact the average go? I didn't know. Frankly, this is the first time you and I have talked. I've exchanged emails from you. You could have been in Tahiti. You could have been in Buenos Aires, Argentina. You could have been halfway around the world for all I knew. It didn't matter to me that you weren't sitting in Austin. How did people know that you weren't in Portland?
This was 10 years ago, and our sense of virtual place was less strong than it is now. And on a very real level, mm-hmm. you know, at that point for a music festival, we were, people had to send in their tape or their CD or whatever. And they were sending it to an address in Austin, which I think was a big mistake. We should have just had a PO box in Portland. It was something that really, you know, stood out as, wait, I'm applying to Portland, but I'm sending it to Austin. So that was a mistake. Now, one of the things that we did to help try to improve our relationship in the community was come up with a Portland advisory board that had a lot of input into the tone and flavor of the event. That's something that we've certainly incorporated into South by Southwest Interactive, where we have now a 60 to 70 person advisory board that helps with the panel evaluation, or the evaluation process of the panel picker. So, learned out of that situation, or continue to learn, that getting advice and input from people on the ground is very important. And maybe their advice is not great in that you can ultimately use, but the process of soliciting and communicating and seeking that advice opens a lot of doors that you need open for you.
Do you have an example of a door that opens because of the advisors and where they're from?
On the Portland end, I'm I'm not sure I can process one of those memories at present, but for the interactive end, yeah, again, we, the advisors play about a 40% role in terms of the decision-making process on any given panel. So the idea, our panel proposal. So the idea is that these people are evaluating the proposals in addition to the voting from the public, and that helps to counteract some of the popularity, the idea that the panel picker is a popularity contest. But again, it's great to have these advisors, these people working with the event who are all over the U.S. and some that are based internationally that can, again, give their input on what the trends are that we should be paying more attention to, and what the trends are that we should be paying less attention to, and who are some of the hottest speakers and the hottest ideas.
All right, so let's go back to 1994. You guys decide, all right, we're not going to syndicate this. It will not be a Dubai South by Southwest. Dubai will have to create their own. We're going to just add more to this one. You come up with South by Southwest Interactive. What's the first thing that you do to get this off the ground?
Well, you know, we had a really, really hard time getting it off the ground. And partly because it was a very different model or very different way of business or way of doing business or thinking about business than what we've done on the music side of things. I mean, again, as I mentioned earlier, we had leveraged all these alternative papers around the U.S. to help get the word out on the music event. Now, that didn't work so well for the interactive end of things simply because it's not quite the same audience. So, you know, we tried to hit computer around the U.S. and none of those I don't think are as nearly successful as the alternative papers. We, you know, tried to do trades with other events. We tried to get our name out there however possible. And, you know, at that point, the bulk of panel programming was organized directly by me, and it would be I read an article in Wired or Industry Standard at that point or whatever, and was like, wow, that person sounds pretty neat. I'll track him or her down and see if this person would like to speak at South by Southwest. And that was kind of the initial way to push forward on this, and had some good results, but nowhere near what we've had in the last 4 or 5 years.
You said that the model wasn't quite right. What was that original model?
I'm just saying in terms of how to market the thing. I mean, there wasn't using the model from South by Southwest Music to market this thing. Going to music papers was not, certainly didn't apply to this, and it was certainly a different kind of people or kind of person that we wanted to attend interactive than was attending music. And again, my perspective is that 10 or 12 years ago or 15 years ago when we started this thing, the division between the geeks on this side who are doing multimedia stuff, CD-ROMs, whatever, and the musicians on this side was, you know, there was a gap there. Whereas now, you know, it is much closer together and there's a lot more overlap. Certainly if you're come to Austin for all of South by Southwest Week, you do see a bit of a sea change on Wednesday when the music people start coming in, the jeans are that much tighter and the tattoos become full body tattoos and stuff. But otherwise, you know, it's hard to see a lot of difference between the creatives who are in the first part of the week for interactive and film and the musicians who are in later in the week for music.
Especially since musicians now are screaming out their Twitter handles. Follow me on Twitter.
Absolutely. We preach convergence a lot, and every year it's the two audiences are harder and harder to separate.
How do you trade with other conferences? You mentioned earlier that there was some kind of trade that you do.
Well, again, when we were in this phase of how do we grow this thing, how do we get this to create more momentum, you know, we started taking a very open source approach in this. I mean, maybe we can trade with other conferences where we can give them a badge to South by Southwest. If they give us a badge to their event, we can go to their event and market ourselves there, and they can come to our event and vice versa. And again, the idea was to try to figure out any way possible to create more interest in the event. And again, I feel like one of the things that we did somewhat differently on the music side of things is very much an open source approach, or you know, we'll help you promote your event if you will help us promote our event.
So a few years ago, a younger Hugh was walking around other conferences with those little Kinko slips, maybe the laminated looking kind, and handing them out to people at conferences saying, hey, check out South by Southwest Interactive.
Yeah, and we still do that to some extent.
But that was you walking around and showing the stuff.
Sure.
Really? What was that like? I used to hand out those flyers for my dad as a kid. That's what drove me. I said, I never want to be reduced to doing this again. This was in the ghetto.
It wasn't that bad, but...
No, so what was it like for you to do that?
Well, you know, again, 10 years ago, we were... when we were pushing South by Southwest Interactive, we... probably say, you may never have heard of us, but you've heard of South by Southwest music. You know, this is a great opportunity to come down and talk about tech and see some great bands. And that was kind of our entree into to people's attention. And gradually, it has become more of its own thing, where people are more likely just to come down to the tech side. But yeah, I think with conference organizing, as with any other event or any other product, you have to learn and become comfortable with selling yourself and selling, you know, selling what you do and reaching out to people, reaching out to strangers and trying to persuade them to buy into what you're doing. It's not the thing that I'm most comfortable with, but certainly I've done it at times. And when I get into that mode or that rhythm, I can be pretty good at it, I think.
Hey, by the way, are they chopping wood behind you? Are they drilling? I guess you got
a
window open.
I'm sending you a bundle of mail tomorrow. Yes, that's late spring, the late fall harvest.
Hugh, I did a lot of events, and I remember once having a major athlete, I won't give the guy's name, agree to come out and speak at one of my events. I said, this is terrific. He's going to come. He's going to be a huge draw, and people will love watching him. And sure enough, people did come who knew him from when they were kids. He comes in. The first thing he does, he goes, I'd like to bow down and say a word to Jesus. He starts doing a prayer. I'm like, this is a business event. Who knows if any of these people even believe in Jesus? Am I imposing religion on them? Where is he going with this? And from there, it just went downhill, believe me. How did you back then, what did you do? In fact, I know that you must have had bad speakers. What did you do back then when a speaker was bad?
Well, I mean, I think you can remove the back then from your statement.
You're saying it even happens now?
Sure. And ultimately,
like with who, for example?
Well, I think that our most obvious example was the Mark Zuckerberg keynote from a couple of years back with a keynote interview with Sarah Lacey. And that was a spectacular failure in the sense that Facebook was just beginning to break, getting mainstream attention. Mark hadn't spoken in many places yet. We were very honored that he was coming to South by Southwest to speak. We had this packed house to see him and got him on stage, and the interview was just a complete dud. And the flip side of that is it was right when Twitter was breaking. People were all in the audience were tweeting each other, you know, like, is it just me or does this not good? And everyone said, no, it's not good. So ultimately it became this great kind of case study in the new dynamics of audiences. And we were able and got a lot of press that way and maybe able to deflect some of the problems there. But I think that as an organizer, I mean, we step back and realize, you know, we just did not prepare this person very well or vet the interview very well, and we've got to do a much better job of preparing. And you know, again, we had plenty of duds at the 2010 event, and in every case, I think we can go back and say, wait, we thought we had organized this enough. We thought we knew that the star athlete wasn't going to give a prayer to start the thing, but we needed to go over that word for word. And so conference planning is like, again, any other business, in that the more you prepare and the more you figure out every detail and leave nothing to chance, the better your chances of success. And even at that, you know, who knows what happens. At this year's event, first day of the event, had packed panel rooms, everything going well. All of a sudden, the fire alarm goes off at the convention center and everyone has to evacuate the building. Now, we have a better contingency plan for that for 2011, but we didn't have a contingency plan for 2010, and it was, you know, kind of a drag. But to everyone's credit, you know, people filed out of the building and filed back in, and 15 minutes later, all the panels were running again. So sometimes these things happen.
I actually talked to Sarah Lacey soon after that panel. She considers it a career enhancer, that interview that she did. Not because it went off especially well, but because people got to find out about her, people got to talk about her, there was debate about the future of audiences at conferences. Should you allow people to talk? If people are going to talk anyway, how do you deal with it? That was pretty good. What about when someone's just boring? What about when you're just watching them go, good Lord, I'm just subjecting all my people to this. This is what's representing me. You see, the thing about conferences is you're not in charge of everything about it. You're not the guy who's on stage and the guy who's making sure that the air conditioning is fine. You're relying in large part on the person on stage to represent your brand. And when somebody's not representing your brand well, what do you do at that moment?
I don't know. For that, you hope that the hour goes fast. The stuff you mentioned about Sarah is interesting in the sense that I think that her perspective on this is, you know, for better or for worse, where we are now, that, you know, whether it's good or bad, we want publicity one way or another, and that got my name out. And I think that, you know, again, we didn't do a good enough job of preparing Sarah and talking to Sarah about what we expected and what the audience would expect. At the same time, and I say this with all love and respect, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is a hard person to interview, and in many ways, she took the arrow for him on that. I mean, you know, in the sense that, oh, it's a horrible interview, but, you know, again, he's hard to get stuff out of, and it takes a very skillful person to make him more engaging, particularly 3 or 4 years ago when he was that much younger and that much shyer.
Yeah. Let me suggest this. If you do have a – for the conference, put my number on speed dial. If anyone is a dud, I'll step right in there. And I'm not going to take over, but I'll ask the right questions that will get the undud stuff out. Like how much money they're making. My audience loves me to ask that. I would ask Mark Zuckerberg who he was dating, how much money he took off the table. Good juicy questions, not like Sarah Lacey. She's a good friend, but come on.
As always, Andrew, be careful what you ask for or wish for. I'm back to bite you.
Listen, this microphone travels very well. In fact, that's part of the reason why it might be humming. Took it with me to Argentina. You got to see when you go into an airport with a mic like this. This doesn't even look like a mic. Look at that. What is that? It's supposed to be like an old-fashioned mic. Did you ever see an old-fashioned mic that looked like this?
That's great.
You prepare people. You prepare your panelists, you prepare your speakers. How do you prepare someone to be good?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, the bulk of preparation that we do, or a lot of our preparation, you know, is on very mundane stuff. You know, where they have to be before the panel, where they pick up their badge, where the Austin Convention Center is, that type of stuff. And you know, we found that even getting that information and getting people to absorb that information is difficult. In terms of how to prepare people to be good, you know, I think that we've taken a more aggressive attitude in recent years about asking speakers what they're going to talk about, what exactly they're going to talk about, what angle they're going to talk about, how are they going to do that. And that's, again, trying to learn from some of these spectacular failures in the past. You know, it's interesting that we definitely try to run a balance at South by Southwest of trying to get a lot of new speakers in the event, people who haven't spoken before, people who have new ideas, just because, you know, I like new ideas. I think new ideas and creativity is very important. At the same time, the more we do this, the more we realize that, you know, again, Gary Vee has talked everywhere And lots of people have heard him or seen him on TV or whatever. But again, he knows how to deliver. I mean, you can see him. You can see him 20 times. And the 21st time, you're still, you know, wow, he's got the act down or the speech down. And so there is something to be said, or a lot to be said, for people who have that presentation factor. And again, I'm not trying to deflect our role or downplay our role in here. But, you know, speaking is not an easy thing to do. I know that as a conference organizer and as someone who has spoken at panels and gotten, God, that just wasn't very good. There is a talent to this, and a rhythm to this. And again, with most cases, the more someone does this, the more they're comfortable with it, the more they can give a compelling presentation. And often, you know, a speaker who's compelling can talk about a less interesting topic and make it sound interesting, versus a speaker who isn't compelling, who doesn't know how to deliver, can talk about a very exciting topic and not make it sound interesting.
You ask some speakers to not just prepare points that they want to talk about, but to send them to you. That seems to help, right?
Sure.
What else do you do? What else do you ask them for ahead of time that helps speakers shine on stage or at least keep the audience entertained?
Well, you know, again, there's lots of very mundane stuff here, ranging from photo and bio. We're also, you know, if someone's organizing a panel, we're wanting to know, obviously, who the other speakers are and what each speaker brings to the table. I mean, certainly one of the things that we have found, or we think we understand, is that panels, when they're good, can be really, really good, but more often than not, they have a tendency to go off track. And partly that's because there's not someone on the panel who's a real devil's advocate. I mean, conflict is good on a panel. Having someone who will strongly disagree with the others and challenge them on that point can be unpleasant, but it's drama. And we all like drama and conflict. And often we'll go into a panel thinking that John Smith, he's the devil's advocate, and then he turns out that he doesn't, you know, he just agrees with everyone else, and that contributes to dudness. So again, trying to, before the event, figure out who exactly is bringing what perspective to a panel. And again, we've really steered in recent years more towards solo presentations or dual presentations, simply because we find that people prepare for those more, therefore the sessions tend to be better and more in-depth. I think there's a psychology when you're on a panel and you're a busy executive, as most of these people are, that I don't really have to prepare that much because that guy's going to do all the talking and I can just kind of follow along. And if everyone on the panel does that, then no one's prepared and the session...
The problem is everybody on a panel seems to do that. The moderator seems to think, hey, it's not about me. I just need to ask questions. Well, I can ask questions. I can just think of them on the spot. And the first question that a moderator like that always asks is, tell everyone what you do. And then the panelists go into long commercials, or most people don't even know how to explain what they do. And so they go and they try one direction and then say, but it's not really that, it's another thing. And the people on the panel, the panelists themselves, think that they don't need to prepare anything. They don't have any interesting stories. They don't have a point of view necessarily. They're just going to answer questions, and it just fails. I blame the moderator, frankly. It's true. Hey.
Yes, but again,
100%. It's the moderator's responsibility to call the guests ahead of time, to take points from them ahead of time, to let them know what direction they're going in. And if it's going to be a little bit WWE or World Wrestling Entertainment, then let's figure out who stands where and hold them accountable to that. Have a few statements from those guests so that you can come back to them and say, hey, you know what, but before this, before you were sitting face to face, this is what you told me about them.
Sure. Yes. Again, this flows into the more organized and the more everything can be scripted out or somewhat scripted out, the better it can be. But again, you know, at my end, I've been on sessions before, spoken on sessions that I thought, wow, I have a great game plan for this going in, and it just didn't fly. And that dynamic of bringing four people together is difficult to pull off. When it comes off well, it can be spectacular, but more often than not, in our experience at least, it doesn't come off well. One person is not engaged, or one person wants to talk about you know, iPhones when everyone else is talking about iPads, and it seems like that'll work, but it just comes off to the audience as a scattered conversation and not what I came here to hear.
All right, what about payment? Who gets paid to speak at South by Southwest, and who just gets a free ticket?
Good question. We do not pay anyone to speak at South by Southwest. It's always been a issue where we give people a comp badge, and that works for a lot of people. For some people, it doesn't work, and I totally respect that decision. But they, you know, we with as many speakers as we have, we just don't have budget to pay these people. And at this point, I mean, I think it was a harder sell 10 years ago. At this point, speaking at South by Southwest can open a lot of doors and is a prestigious thing, can lead to or can help someone get a book deal or add more to their blog following or tweet following or whatever. And so, you know, we don't have quite as much of a problem with that as we had before, or as it was in previous years. But again, at the end of the day, we're offering that grand concept of exposure to people.
So I actually had the organizer of Big Omaha on, and he said that he paid Gary Vaynerchuk and even was pretty open about how much he paid him. You're saying that you got the same speaker, bigger stage, bigger audience, no money.
Correct.
Wow. So how do you get speakers? Let's talk about Mark Zuckerberg. How do you get him to come out to South by Southwest, do a live interview with a reporter who's going to ask potentially challenging questions?
Well, certainly what we have to sell to a speaker is that, you know, they're going to get significantly more out of the event by participating in the event than they would by not.
Selling Mark Zuckerberg? I'm curious specifically about him because he doesn't need the exposure. Maybe he does. He doesn't need, I don't know. It seems like he had a lot even back then going for him. Was it you who was convincing him? How'd you do it?
I was the lead on that and found a PR person who, one of the internal Facebook PR people who was very interested in South by Southwest. And, you know, I was able to sell her on the concept, and then she was able to sell her higher-ups and Zuckerberg on the concept.
How'd you sell her? What's the pitch?
Well, at that point, again, it was, you know, we've got this great audience of cutting-edge web developers, technology trendsetters, you know, digital savants, people who are, you know, need to be sold on the value of Facebook. I mean, some of them are very into it already. Others are still on the edge. This is where all the smartest people come to meet, all the most creative people come to meet. This is where Mark needs to be to get this message across. And that was a compelling that was a compelling reason for them at that point.
How'd you prove that you had the leaders, the savants as you call them, the people who are going to use the smartphone before most people even know what a smartphone is?
Well, we certainly got a lot of press and publicity and buzz out of Twitter at the 2007 event, and Twitter had actually released, I think, 2 or 3 months before South by Southwest. But
we might have just lost the connection. If we did, Hugh, I'm going to call you right back, and we'll, there we go. I thought we lost the connection. You're saying Twitter just released, but, and then the screen froze on your side. And hopefully.
Hi there.
Yeah, do you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay. Sorry, so you were saying Twitter just released, but, and then we lost after.
Twitter had released 2 or 3 months before South by Southwest 2007. They did a big marketing push at the event, meaning that they had paid for these big television screens that we had in the hallways that were broadcasting a Twitter feed live. So for a lot of the people coming to South by Southwest, this is the first time they kind of saw Twitter, realized what it could do, began to guess some of the possibilities here, and it had it was one of the first big spikes in enrollment and interest and buzz about that service. We've you know, used that example as as a way to get a lot of speakers in, a lot of companies in terms of, look, this audience, again, who comes to the event, they are very, very aggressive in terms of blogging about what they like, about having friends who they will talk to about what they like. And so, you know, coming to South by Southwest and making a good impression, that's going to, it's a great way to again, enhance your career, enhance the reputation of your product, and get the word out to the people who will reach lots of other people.
How profitable is South by Southwest Interactive?
I think it's a comfortably profitable product now, or event now. Again, I think for the first 12 years of our existence, had we had to survive on our own, we would not have been able to. Again, we were essentially funded and underwritten and supported by South by Southwest Music, but have finally, again, achieved our own revenue streams, significant revenue streams in the last 4 or 5 years.
I think South by Southwest brings in $110 million of business to Austin. The whole conference,
sure,
and to the city of Austin, including bars and the hotels and everything else. But can you give me a sense of how much revenue it draws for itself, the interactive portion?
I wish I could. I don't have those exact figures.
Is it over $10 million?
I would guess so.
Okay. And profit over $5 million?
I don't know on that. No.
Have you gotten rich enough that you can afford to walk around with a monocle and a top hat? No. All right.
I don't know. Just do monocle and top hats go for?
No, it's not the cost of them. It's the ability to earn the monocle and the top hat.
Yeah. I see.
Mark Zuckerberg, just so you know, he wore a monocle and top hat and white gloves for the whole interview here when I interviewed him on Mixergy. But that's a whole other category. He had his butler hold his mic.
Yes, things have changed a lot at the interactive end over the last few years in terms of being able to live a more comfortable living. But again, I mean, I don't think people get in the conference organizing business to get rich. There are probably other ways to, better ways to do that. And ultimately, I think that, you know, organizing a conference, as you know, is a lot of work. It requires lots of sleepless nights and lots of worry, but it is a lot of fun. And when it goes well, and hopefully South by Southwest generally goes well, and you have people coming up to you and saying, this is the highlight of my year, you know, I had so much fun here, I met other people, I got a new job, I, you know, met my wife here, you know, that's...
Are you allowed, as an organizer, and are the people who work for you allowed to date attendees of the music or film?
If we had the time, Andrew, if we had the
really?
Time.
Really? So all these people come in and you guys aren't allowed to date any of them?
I'm not saying, I don't think there's anything that's strictly forbidden on that. I think it's that we're attending to other duties aside from our social life at that.
We're about 50 minutes into a podcast. Nobody listens to podcasts in the first place. We talk business here, so even fewer people still listen. So this is just pretty much a conversation, you, me, your mother, my mother, and a couple of their friends. Have you ever dated anybody at South by Southwest? That's one of the reasons why I got into conference spaces, and I met my wife at an event that I organized.
I have dated people on staff before. I don't know that I've dated attendees, although I will say that part of the growth of the interactive event was learning to not date staff people.
You dated someone on staff?
Yes.
Wow, for how long?
Quite a while, several years.
So it was a serious relationship?
Absolutely.
Wow. And so when you guys broke up, and it sounds like you broke up, was it tough? Was it messy? Is it inappropriate to ask? It was tough and messy?
Yes.
How was it messy? What happened?
Well, I mean, all breakups are messy. And luckily, she at that point no longer worked for the event, so that made it a little bit easier. But, you know, I mean, again, this flows into just, you know, learning better maturing as a person, maturing as an organization, realizing that as much fun as it is to date someone who's doing the same thing that you are and always having something to talk about in that regard, that there are a lot of downsides to that, and maybe that's not what you should do.
But didn't it kill you that all these girls were coming into this event? They were all getting drunk. They were all looking beautiful and wearing their flip-flops, so they were just in a relaxed mode. And you couldn't date any of them because you already had a date who was on staff. You couldn't even really flirt.
You know, and you have a much different perspective of the event than I do. Sitting here managing, wondering how to, spin the Mark Zuckerberg, in a positive way.
Yes, how much spinning did you do of that? How did you...
We didn't, honestly, we didn't spin it that much. I think the community ran with it. And in some ways, as you mentioned with Sarah Lacey, she views this as a career-changing event. I mean, this got the word out about South by Southwest to many, many, many more people who'd never heard of the
event. What do you do to juice that? What do you do to make sure that people hear about all the good things that are going on in South by Southwest? Beyond, I know that they're going to tweet about it. I know they're going to blog about it. But what do you do to make sure that beyond the Twittersphere and the blogosphere, that word gets out?
Well, I think at this point, I'm not sure that I agree with the beyond stuff. I mean, it has created its own media storm at this point. And we're not, at least I don't think we have quite the sophistication to manage that. But again, over the last 3 or 4 years, 10 years ago, we were begging people to come to cover the event.
Tell me about that period, the tough period. It lasted how long, about 4 or 5 years?
Well, I would say that it lasted maybe to about 2000, from when we started to 2002, 2003. And to me, the big change kind of the watershed moment, tipping point, if you will, to use the lingo, is when we started adopting the panel picker stuff. We had done a contest with Threadless for a design contest with Threadless, and I was just totally amazed at how much buy-in that contest got, how many people submitted, because we had done similar design contests off the South by Southwest website, and we'd get 10 or 15 entries. This thing on Threadless got 600 entries, so I thought, well, can we do something similar to this with the whole concept of panel submissions or panel ideas? And so we were able to find someone who could build an interface, and the initial interface was a little bit clunky, and it's gotten a little better every year. Basically, when you boil everything down, it's a good way to communicate with our audience and to show our audience, how they can be involved with this event, and it's a great viral marketing thing where people are talking to their friends about, vote for my panel for proposal for South by Southwest. So it has created, a buzz for the event during the summer when there never used to be a buzz. It's given us a wealth of content ideas. I mean, way more great content than we have room for. And again, it's kind of formalized a process that always occurred but just wasn't very formal before. And by that, I mean that, somebody would email me and say, hey, I spoke at South by Southwest. I'm an expert on, web development. Let me organize this panel next year. And I'd be like, great. You know a hell of a lot more about web development than I do. But a lot of people didn't know how to email me or didn't know my email address. So now it's a lot more transparent to a lot more people in terms of how they can get involved with the event. And the number of proposals that have been sent into the panel picker has steadily increased over the last few years. And again, it's kind of pre-identifying what your community is and reaching out to that community and pulling the best ideas in from that community and being able to see the trends that the community likes or interests from the community. So again, I always feel that that's really where we started to hit a tipping point, is when we instituted that or brought that in to determine a lot of our content.
What was the before and after on that? How big was the event before, and how big was it after you did that?
Before we did it, we had something like 1,000 people coming. And look at what you mentioned to start the interview off. Last year we had more than 14,000. So it was, you know, just a big, big difference. And you know, we didn't really know how well this would work. When we first started doing this, we were thinking, well, maybe we can choose 3 or 4 panels like this. And now it's 70 or 80 or even higher percentage of the programming that way. And again, the point is, you know, one of the strengths here is that it's getting people who are experts to organize sessions about what they are expert in, as opposed to me or someone else in my staff reading a magazine article and trying to put together, a content based on that magazine article or a web article or whatever. So again, leveraging the strengths of this community, the creativity of this community to help pull the event forward.
There's something that you mentioned earlier that I wanted to come back to. You said that you are carefully growing the community. I was wondering what you did to grow the community so well. It's still an authentic community. It's still one that people want to be a part of. And if they're not physically there, they want to be a part of it remotely on Twitter, or follow along on Leo Laporte's show when he's down there. How did you do that?
Well, I think that I think that the panel picker was a great way to communicate and establish a basis of communication with this community. I also, you know, believe very strongly in a lot of the ideas that a lot of the best speakers from South by Southwest have preached. I mean, I always talk to my staff, and when I'm asked to speak, about this idea of markets or conversations, you know, that the more we engage with our audience by email over the fall and summer and spring, the more goodwill we're building up. I really liked the Tony Hsieh opening remarks from a couple of years ago at South by Southwest, and his whole mantra and idea that, you know, customer service is the new marketing. And so in terms of building a community, I mean, this has definitely gotten harder and harder to do, but, you know, really try to preach to my staff and myself that we answer emails as quickly as possible. We may not be able to answer positively, but we treat people in a respectful way and say thanks for your contribution. And again, trying to be as open to the insights from this community as possible. And the more we've, you know, been open to listening to this community about what they want, as opposed to us telling them what we think they want, the more we've grown. You know, certainly there are hiccups along the way and there are challenges along the way. Again, you know, I think that this whole idea of customer service, I mean, ultimately that's what we're, even less so than technology, that's what we're in the business of providing.
What kind of customer service do you do beyond? I know you answer your emails really fast, and it's not just true. It's intimidatingly fast.
You know, we're trying to the email thing, the improving the experience when people check in, the being friendly to people when they check in. You know, helping them with other stuff. And again, I mean, we know and have understand that when these people have a positive experience in Austin, they're going to blog about it, they're going to tweet about it, they're going to write about it on their Facebook page, and that generates, you know, a mountain of continued interest in the event. By comparison, if they come to the event and they don't like the panels, or they feel like they got treated rudely, or they didn't have a positive experience, they're going to broadcast that as well. So again, I mean, it's this whole idea of your customer has a megaphone now, and we got to be conscious of that and got to be attentive to their wants and needs.
All right, final question. Big shocker, Andrew Warner's panel, designed by Hugh Forrest, did not get picked for South by Southwest. What up with that?
This is not true, Andrew. This is the real truth. There is Andrew Warner's panel did not make the first round of announcements, which was the first 200 that were announced on September 20th. We still have about 300 or 400 more ideas to announce. The next announcement will be November 8th. And you know, I mean, I hate to sound like cliched or marketing speak, but you know, what is hard to convey to our audience and to people who send in these ideas is that the process of going through these ideas is incredibly difficult and incredibly time-consuming. And if the panel picker were just a if we just relied on those votes, it would be easier to do. But again, we're trying to rely on mix those votes in with what our advisory board says, with how we, what we want the tone and feel of the event to be.
How can I not be part of the tone and feel? I've asked money questions and relationship questions. What else is there? Health. Find out about, I'll bring a dying person out there. I'm willing to do that.
You're bringing a dying person
out
there.
Look, a dying person or a totally fit person. Yes, hot women who are totally fit. I will talk about money, and I will wear a monocle and a top hat.
See, if you'd only included those basic
descriptions. I should have listed it.
Yes, that would have put it right over the top immediately, and you would have been at the top of that list of...
No, in all openness. I mean, and understand that I can edit this interview at this point any way I want. But in all openness, what was it about the panel that didn't get you guys excited right away? I want to understand, believe me, I don't take things personally. I wouldn't have brought up I wouldn't have brought up that I didn't make it if I take anything personally. I care more about the answers than anything else.
I searched on our list before we had the interview, and I thought we had accepted the thing. So I know we talked about it a lot, which is, again, to say, I don't think it's out of the running yet. I think it's something that we're still talking about. We thought it was a good idea. And, again, what is really, really difficult about the panel picker is this year we have about 2,500 total ideas. I mean, there are about 150 of those that you can kind of slice off the top immediately in terms of this isn't very well organized or, doesn't seem like a topic for our audience. But beyond that, there are a hell of a lot of very good ideas by very creative people that, on any given day you can make an argument, wow, this is a great thing. And I'm not, I'm not trying to deflect too much. I'm just saying that these are very, very hard decisions. When we look at the community voting, it's like, the ski race joke. I mean, the difference between the person who's at the very top and the person who's didn't score quite as well tends to be very small. And again, we've made some colossal mistakes on things we didn't pick in the past and made some really good choices. So my long answer to your short question is your particular proposal is something that's still very much in the mix, and certainly if we don't take this session, it's the concept itself is something that's certainly perfect for South by Southwest about, finding your tribe and leading your tribe. And this is, very much in tone or in flavor with the event.
All right. I'm going to go edit this to make you look like you don't like puppies and South by Southwest grills puppies. I don't know. Thanks for doing the interview.
And cats also. Don't forget that.
Please, Joe, edit that in twice. Cats. Everybody loves the lol. And have some lol cats from Ben Ha's website just flash across the screen. All right. Well, thank you. I won't push any further. I was curious. I wanted to bring it up, but I'm not looking to make you feel uncomfortable, and I'm certainly not looking to make the audience feel uncomfortable. Audience, please, it's your job to make you feel uncomfortable at this point. Hugh, what's your email address?
I am Hugh, H-U-G-H, at sxsw.com.
All right. Fire away, people. I really love South by Southwest. One way or the other, I hope to make it out there, if for no other reason than just to see the people who walk out in the streets. It's beyond the conference itself. When you're out there just kind of hanging out and you run into people who you've worked with or who you've read their blogs for a long time or whose companies you admire, you just get to have that one-on-one conversation. As helpful as it is for me to do these interviews, sometimes those one-on-one conversations are even more insightful, even if they're 3 minutes. So... what I'm trying to say here before I choke, thanks for putting the conference on. Thanks for doing this interview. I'm looking forward to meeting you in person.
Sure. Well, thanks so much for having me on, and thanks for the nice words. And again, to echo what you're saying there, I mean, we do a lot of work in terms of trying to do a compelling slate of panels, but I think we all are very understanding that at the end of the day, it's all about community. It's about those serendipitous connections you make with the person who's in the bathroom line that you find out is the author of the blog you read every day or whatever. And again, it's bringing this community of very, very creative people together and just kind of watching the connections and ideas that flow forth from there.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to flowing forth with your audience March 2011. Thanks for doing the interview.
March 11th to 15th. Thanks, Andrew.
You bet.